Today is July the 5th, 2017. Welcome to the Personal Computer Show, the original radio program on all things personal computing. I'm Hank Key, and we can be heard each Wednesday on the Progressive Radio Network, PRN.FM, on the Internet at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, and on WBAI FM 99.5 New York on the radio at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. Our website is pcradioshow.org. Our broadcasts are available for downloading from prn.fm, wbai.org, and our website, pcradioshow.org. When WBAI is fundraising, we may be preempted by a replacement program, but we continue with a regularly scheduled weekly program on prn.fm. Next week, we have a special. On July 12th, we will have a special broadcast on the convergence of technology with health issues. This is a very important issue because the computer is now becoming a greater part of technical issues that's hitting us. And Dr. Alfred Poor and Dan Rosenbaum had a discussion on it, and it's very interesting. I think you're going to be enjoying it. That's next week, July 12th. But before we get on with the news for the past week, I have some housekeeping to do. I got a call the other day from someone who got a computer, an old computer, and he said to me, I want to get this computer up and running. I says, okay, so what do you want done? He says, well, there's an operating system on it. I don't want to blow it away because I don't have any other operating system. And so I said to him, well, how old's the computer? He doesn't know. Can you get into it? He can't get into it because there's a password on it. So I said, you have access to a different computer? He says, yes. So if you happen to have a Windows a system, and let's say it's gifted to you, or you had forgotten the password to get into the Windows operating system, here's what you can do. And preferably you do this before you get into trouble. But if you do, find another machine that can do it. Do a search on the following words: Trinity Rescue Kit. That's three words: Trinity Space Rescue Space Kit, and download that program. It's an ISO file, which is a binary file, and with it, with that ISO file, you can download any one of the loaders with it: a CD or DVD loader. In other words, an optical reader. Or from a USB drive from the ISO. I normally would recommend a USB drive. And from there, what you do is you have to get into the Windows computer. I call it Windows computer. It's really a computer. It doesn't know whether it has Windows or not. You get into this setup or the BIOS. I call it BIOS, but everyone calls it setup. You get into the setup mode, and you change the boot to the USB as being the first device to be read. And when you do that, you'll bring up the Trinity Rescue Kit, and one of the options is password bypass. And from there, it doesn't really know what the password is, but what you do is you change the password to whatever you want it to be, and it comes up. And one reason why you may want to do this is you want to preserve the operating system because, well, for any particular reason, while I was doing an update on the operating system, it had a read error on the update. And the way the current machines are set up, there's no parity checking. And when you go through an update where there's a bad read error, it can corrupt your operating system. So what happens then is that you cannot, it can screw up the password. So if you happen to have a Windows system, that's how you can get past the Windows password, and you could either then go into the factory reset or just use the operating system. And if the machine was gifted to you, I'm sure that it's not a problem where you continue to use the operating system. Although I would probably say that whoever gifted to you probably should have cleaned the data off of it first. Now, he or she may have cleaned the data off already before giving to you, and might have screwed up the way of getting onto, you know, being able to boot it up. So, but if you give someone a machine, you have one of two choices: either clean up the machine, take all your personal data off, scrub the machine, make sure there's no a way of recovering data where someone can find out what had been on the machine, or go through a factory reset and just reload another operating system on top of it. Or what you can do is you can download a Linux distro, which can put another operating system on, and then you could do whatever you want with it. Now, similarly, last week I also got an almost identical question, and the person said to me, sent me an email saying that she has a MacBook, and she was happy to get it, but she doesn't know the password to get on it. So I said to her, there's a password reset utility, and what you do is when you bring up the Mac, you hit the Command and the R. In other words, you hold down the Command key and hit the R at the same time, and you go into recovery mode. In the recovery mode, then you can get to the point where you're able to reset the password. She wrote back to me saying that she was a little, let's put it this way. She was a little confused about it. So I said, tell you what, in the case of Apple, you could take it to the Apple store, which is what she did, and they did it for her, and she's very happy. So in the case of Windows and in the case of the Mac OS X, if there is a problem in booting up because of a password, there's a way of getting around it. Although I ask a very simple question. If it's so easy to get past the Windows password or the OS X password, where's the security in all this? Well, that's another story. I also had a question that is somewhat representative of many other questions I've gotten now. I often get a lot of questions on, I want to buy a computer, here's what I want to do, and what should I get? Well, I always come back to them and say, what do you want to run on it? Because form follows function. Because what you want to run on it makes up, defines what hardware you need. But this person had a slightly different question. I need a computer to get some work done on it, to estimate a job. It's a job site I go to, from site to site. And there, that's an interesting question. And I said to myself, gee, he probably needs something that needs either OS X or Linux or Windows, but I don't think he can run it with iOS or Android because he probably has some application in mind. So the question I asked him was, what application do you have in mind? I'm waiting for an answer, but what you do is if you have an application in mind, identify what it is and then ask yourself a simple question. Then what operating system does it run on? And then from there, on a job site point of view, there's other things you have to also consider is that where are these job sites are you going to, and is it in many different places? Because you're going to need the internet. And unless the customer or prospective customer has a internet for you to use, you're going to need it. So what you probably need is a hotspot from one of the vendors, like T-Mobile has a hotspot device, Verizon has it, and the others have it. So that's one of the things that you have to consider. So then you have to take the whole thing. Now, one of the things I would like to see him be able to do is that, gee, if all he wants to do is be able to do some office functions, well, you can run some office functions on smartphones or tablets and so on. And, you get on the internet because on a job site, and I kind of suspect that it might be a construction job site, you want to carry the minimal equipment. Can you imagine carrying a full-size laptop and big screen and then you have all the paraphernalia, power supply, everything with it? You want to keep it as simple as possible. So I don't know what he needs, but if you need a computer, you have to ask yourself all those questions. Well, let's get to the news of the week, okay? The big news, to me, was a big news. It was a unanimous decision. Unanimous in the sense that it was an 8-0 decision. Gorsuch didn't vote on it. The Supreme Court reaffirmed that there's no such thing as a separate category called hate speech. What happened was that there was a Asian American dance rock band that formed in 2006, and they tried to trademark the name Slants. And the government says, no, Slants, you can't be used because they feel that it might be demeaning to Asian Americans. Well, the fact that this band is made up of four men who are Asian American to begin with, but the First Amendment does not entrust that kind of a power to the government and let them determine whether you can or cannot use it. Instead, our reliance must be on the substantial safeguard of free and open discussion in a democratic society. And that is quite interesting, because what now we're saying is that from a government point of view, there is no separate category for hate speech. Now, people would say, okay, so this rock band now can have the name Slant. So what does it mean? Well, the ruling itself, if that's all you read, that's all you got out of it. But there were two, three other things that comes out of it. And I've been reading up on this case. The Washington Redskins, they've been having problems where they had been threatened by the government that their trademark Redskins would be pulled unless they change a name. Well, guess what? They can keep that name. The problem that I have with hate speech is I don't like it. But who determines what is hate speech? Now, what Joe King, my colleague, said to me is, if he determines what is hate speech, then he's fine with it. I said, Joe, what if I determine what is hate speech? He says, oh, no. Only I can determine what it is. So this goes a long way. Ain't nothing decision. But there was another case, though, in Canada that Google lost the case on a 7-2 vote. And what it is that Google is caught in the middle. What happens is that there was a lawsuit filed by Barnaby, which is a British Columbia-based industrial networking vendor, and they have a company called Equestec Solutions, Inc., and they're alleging, now they didn't prove, but they're alleging that a competitor by name of Data Link Technologies Gateways was selling a technology that they claim that they own. And a lower court told Data Link, knock it off, but the firm then just moved from one province to another and on some unknown location, so that every time Google did a search on the technology, the Data Link would come up. Well, it finally got to the Canadian Supreme Court, and they said that although they reject free speech arguments, it's a tough one, because what they ordered was that this is not an order to remove speech. That what it does is that it's asking Google and forcing Google to de-index the website because it was in violation of several court orders. Now, the problem here is that they can de-index it, but Data Link can move from site to site within Canada, and how about outside of Canada? So the court ruling also said they want this ruling to be effective not only in Canada, but the rest of the world. How are you going to enforce that in the rest of the world? Now, if it was if Data Link had a website set up in the United States and they claimed the technology, Canada is going to tell an ISP or a search engine in the United States, hey, you can't do it. We'll see. By the way, the Canadian ruling is not on all search engines. It's only on Google. So I guess they pick on Google's because that's the one that most people use and that's what they can find. But that's very interesting in itself, is that this is going to be a mess, because Canada's saying is that you are in violation if you are providing the search information in a different country, even though it's outside of Canada. Wow. And then there's a third one that has to do with speech that got me going, is that Germany, also in their high court, they are they're giving Google, Facebook, and Twitter, all three of them, 24 hours to remove or block criminal intent from the websites that, you know, and what they provide. And they have 24 hours to get it off. If they don't get it off, they're subject to a $24 million fine. Hey, wait a minute. What determines hate speech in Germany? Well, they have certain symbols. They have certain words. I could see a swastika being treated as a hate symbol. I could see some words that are used that treat a hate symbol, but what it is that in Germany they have a panel that reviews what is considered hate speech. They can determine what is hate. I don't know. It's just to be interesting. Now, what they're also ordering that the Facebook, Twitter, and Google has to give them a six month summary. Every 6 months, they have to summarize how many times they've done it and how many times they've removed material within a 24-hour period. And I read this stuff, and I couldn't believe that. I think Facebook has 190 people involved in just that's all they do is just review material and you know, you take it down for fake news, hate speech, and so on. This is a big mess in terms of what is hate and what is not hate. Oh, boy. And, you know, there's also, by the way, this German law goes into effect October the 8th. I don't know if they can, enforce it because, again, if the search engine is outside of Germany, what do they do? Well, in this case, it's only within Germany itself, but I don't know how they're going to block it. There's another case that came down, and this one is quite interesting, okay? You know, one of the things that we always talk about is the Digital Millennium Law. It's, to me, it's for the birds, okay? It's the intention was good, but it's been brought to a point where it got silly. And tell you how silly it got, okay? The Digital Millennium Law is that you cannot modify or fix or change software or like music and so on and use it as your own. And so the case that brought this up was that car manufacturers were saying, hey, to repair a car, you need some diagnostic software, and you can only do diagnostic software if you are an authorized dealer. Well, some farmers got together and say, hey, we're in a remote location, and they can't wait for a factory rep to okay fixes for agricultural machines, and because they're so far away and, you know, time is money, and they can't wait, more than a day, a week, or 2 weeks to get, some factory machines fixed. So they said they need to be able to do fixes. So the Copyright Office came up with a modification on the Digital Millennium ruling. What they're saying is that bona fide repair and maintenance activities are allowed that are non-infringing. Well, what does non-infringing mean? It means that it's software or the product is no longer in production. Okay. And I'm thinking to myself, hey, I'm a hacker. And does that mean that if it's equipment that is no longer, there's various versions of Windows that are no longer supported, can I play around with that? The Copyright Office, pretty cute. The word they use is bona fide. Well, who determines what is bona fide? They leave that up for interpretation. So right now, if it's bona fide repair and maintenance, that's fine. For tinkerers, you're not allowed, even if the product is obsolete, even if the product is no longer supported. That's going to be interesting. Oh, boy, what is this world coming to anyway? By the way, there is something that I always find interesting is that how much can you squeeze into something? I remember, one of the things, as a kid, when, before we had these small computers, we used to argue about how many angels can you fit on the top of a needle. Well, this is going to be something like that because Microsoft has come up with a program, and they're pretty proud of it. And, well, to me, yeah, they in concept, it's you could call it that, but you need a heck of a lot more power than that. What they did was they put some coating into a Raspberry Pi 3. Now, if anyone has played with a Raspberry Pi, it's slow. It's limited in memory. It's limited in what you can do. Well, what they put on it, they put an artificial intelligence program on it. Wow. In other words, what is artificial intelligence? Well, artificial intelligence is rule-based, and based on those rules, and people call it machine learning, what they do is that you take that information, becomes your part of your history, and then you build on top of that to build more rules, and you optimize those rules, and that's basically what artificial intelligence is. At some point, like the Watson that IBM has, you have enough rules where you become the big winner in chess, you become the big winner in Go because you know all possibilities. Well, this started off as a pet project by a Microsoft person, and he had a problem with squirrels. They're pesky little things, and so he came up with a sensor, and that every time he sensed that there was a squirrels running around, he would turn on the water, and when he turns on the water, of course, water will drive a lot. No animal wants to get wet, and he built on that. So the program is available if you want to play around with it. It runs on the Raspberry Pi 3. And it's artificial intelligence. And now, what Microsoft intends to do is take that particular program and probably break it down into its conceptual form instead of, this was a hack, okay, on a Raspberry Pi. And that's their way of getting into artificial intelligence. I was asked the other day, what is going to be the next big thing in computing? And people talk about, you name it, drones and wearable tech. And it's in all those areas, including things like recharging without, connecting to anything, wireless recharging, enhanced wireless technology. But artificial intelligence will be to the point where it's going to eliminate a lot of the, someone said to me, at what point does it eliminate the human being? Can it? Theoretically, it can, but I don't really see it because you can come up with concepts and you build on rule-based to run those concepts. But if someone comes up with something brand new in terms of technology, someone has to build those rules again. But how fast can you do it? Well, the IBM Watson is now being used in many different areas, and it's quite interesting. I don't know if many of you heard the Dr. Alfred Spohr segment last week. He was talking about how artificial intelligence is being used. And later in the last half hour, he talks more about how artificial intelligence is being used in the health field. And it should be quite interesting because one of the things that I was in the hospital recently, so I would know, they check on patients, overnight patients, they check on them every 4 hours. And then, they go back to their nursing station and when the fourth hour comes up. But not all patients react the same way. They may have a fever. They may need attention before 4 hours. They may not be able to get the attention or ring the buzzer or the bell. But if you happen to have constant monitoring, that is what is going to be happening in that area. And it will make it much better for the patient. So, listen to the segment. It'll be quite interesting. The other item in the news is that I find is that, well, this is more of an announcement more than it did. Well, yeah, it's news, okay? Sony is reopening a plant after closing it 30 years ago. And what do you think they're reopening that they closed up 30 years ago? Vinyl record production. Wow. And not only are they just reprinting or remanufacturing old songs, they're putting new songs on it too, because apparently there's an audience that even with new recordings, they want it in vinyl. Now, the reason why vinyl is a big hit and growing, just to give you an idea, in the United States alone, sales of vinyl records was $500 million last year in the United States. Worldwide, it's in the billions. Can you imagine vinyl records in the United States about almost $500 million last year in sales? That's unbelievable. Well, there's a reason for it. When the music is digital, what do we have? We have these square waves, okay? And you know, the more square, square waves you have within a second, then you know, when you smooth it out, it looks like a straight line or a curve, but it really is little breakdown into little square waves. And you know, the more you have the sawtooths, the finer you have it. With an analog, though, there's no such thing as a sawtooth. It's smooth. It is goes. You know, the dynamic range on it is infinite. Whereas with a digital, not only digital sound, but in the digital pictures, there is just so many square waves you can have within an inch. You could say, well, we can come up with a higher resolution. Well, you can come up with higher and higher resolution, but it's still not infinite. Analog is infinite. And, you know, now I'm not a professional musician, but many professional musicians would say the sound is warmer. The sound just sounds different. Well, at a certain range, I can't hear the difference, but a lot of the musicians says they can hear it, okay? But that's quite interesting. Hey, by the way, some late-breaking news. I'm going to just tell you that Facebook got hit by a court order, and they are taking the government to court on it. The U.S. government has asked Facebook to provide the records, the traffic on three cases, and Facebook want to notify the people, and the government put a gag order on. No, you will not notify them. We're going to follow up on this. That's going to be quite interesting. Now, tonight we have some feature segments, and I think you'll find this of great interest. Dr. Alfred Paul will be talking about telemedicine, how it can save visits to hospitals and doctors. In other words, instead of you going to see a doctor or run to the hospital because of whatever the ailment or the cause may be, to use the diagnostics, wireless or, through communications. And they feel that this could eliminate some of the hospital stays and some of the doctor requirements. Another thing he's going to talk about is remote monitoring for people who stay overnight in hospital stays. But this one is the one that really I feel is really quite interesting, because he has some real statistics on it, and that's a use of AI, that's artificial intelligence, and they have these programs in for early warning on suicides. Wow. Now, I from the tech corner, that's me, someone had asked me, my internet connection is sluggish and slow, and what's the problem? Well, I give it a little dissertation on it. And finally, I was talking to Marty Winston. There's home automation and there's home automation. And I said, Marty, I know what you're talking about, because to me, when I turn on the TV and I use a remote to turn it on and I go through channels, that's not home automation. Well, how's that any different, a thermostat that I use a smartphone to turn the temperature up or down? They call that home automation. Phooey, that's not. So what is home automation? And I said, Marty, can you give me some clarity on what home automation really is and what it's not? So we'll get to those segments right now.
Hello, this is Alfred Poor with news about wearable technology from Health Tech Insider. Have you ever been admitted to a hospital and have to spend the night? If so, you're probably familiar with the routine where a nurse or other technician will come around at some interval and take your temperature and check your blood pressure and other vital signs. The point of this is to find out when changes are happening and hopefully be able to initiate treatment to correct any problems that might be occurring. Well, the standard of care, the normal procedure, is to take the temperature of a patient once every 4 hours. While this is a good practice that most hospitals use, the fact is that changes can happen within those 4 hours that might otherwise be missed and could benefit from treatment sooner than if it's only discovered after 4 hours. A recent study in Cleveland used a wearable patch that took the patient's temperature and then wirelessly sent the temperature to a dashboard at the nursing station and recorded the temperature every 10 minutes rather than once every 4 hours. In the study, the patients were identified as having a temperature rise, a spike in their temperature over 100.4 degrees, using the standard procedure. So the standard procedure detected temperature rise in 23 patients. Now, the remote monitors caught 21 of these, but they also signaled the temperature increase much sooner than the standard care provided. The results showed that the incident was recorded by the remote device anywhere from 30 to 180 minutes sooner. The average was 2 hours and 20 minutes sooner than the standard care identified them. That's a pretty significant difference. So one of the benefits of this approach is it finds out the temperature change in a patient much sooner than the standard care process does. But the other advantage here is that it also offloads some of the work that the nursing staff and the other technicians have to handle. So it does a better job and frees up the medical staff to take care of other tasks that use more of their skill than just running around taking people's temperature. So this remote monitoring turns out to have some real value. If other studies show that this is going to be a practical way to monitor patients while in hospital, you can expect to see more and more hospitals adopt this. Next, I'd like to talk about a study coming out of Norway that shows that in some cases, patients may not need to go to the hospital at all. The study by the Arctic University of Norway was looking at patients who have migraine headaches. Now, migraine headaches are a fairly common condition. They're not life-threatening, but they can be extremely painful. Usually are not associated with some life-threatening or serious complication or underlying condition. In the vast majority of cases, further testing such as MRIs or other kinds of diagnostic procedures really aren't needed. The study in Norway was looking at alternative ways of treating patients with migraines. Part of the problem with Norway is in the north, they have lots of mountains and valleys and fjords, and the geographical terrain makes it very difficult for patients to get into a clinic, a hospital or doctor's office for a visitation. What they looked into was whether telemedicine would be an effective way of treating these patients. They measured the effectiveness of telemedicine consults for a 12-month follow-up period after an initial face-to-face consultation. More than 400 subjects were involved in the test. In the end, they found out that there was no significant difference in terms of the outcomes of the patients, whether they had their follow-ups in person or whether they had them by a telemedicine consultation. So the conclusion of the study is that telemedicine was as effective as the in-person consultations and saves the patient a lot of travel and is more efficient for the healthcare workers and physicians. So this is a good sign that telemedicine may be a good way to treat certain kinds of ailments and conditions going forward in the future. This last item is a little bit dark, but it also has a lot of hope to it. It focuses on suicide. For the U.S., suicide was the 10th most common cause of death in the country, more than 40,000 suicides in 2013 alone. A researcher at Vanderbilt has published a study about using artificial intelligence to help identify patients who might be at risk for harming themselves or potential suicide. And the way he went about this was he created a deep learning system, fed the system health records of many, many patients, and allowed the machine algorithms to develop an analysis of the different patients and see their outcomes. They then took additional historical records and fed it through the system and looked to see if the system would be able to identify which patients were most likely at risk of self-harm or suicide based on the different factors that the artificial intelligence system had identified as being indicators. The results were pretty amazing. They fed the system the records from 13,000 people, and the system was able to successfully predict which of those patients would attempt suicide within the following 2 years of those records. The system was correct 84% of the time in those predictions. What's more, if it was asked to predict who is most likely to be at risk for self-harm or a suicide attempt in just the following 2 weeks from those records, it was able to do so with a 92% accuracy, which is amazing. The goal here of being able to identify who might be at risk for this shows that artificial intelligence and machine learning may be a very powerful tool for this purpose. It may be possible to develop algorithms that will predict other kinds of conditions, mental health, physical health, simply by feeding people's health records through them and making a determination that way. So this could be a very powerful tool for the prevention and treatment of disease using a computer to predict what may happen in the future. For more information, go to healthtechinsider.com. This is Alfred Poor. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Alfred. Is your internet connection running sluggish or slow? Check your other devices such as computers, tablets, and cell phones in your home to see if their internet connection is also slow. If the problem only happens on your device, that one device, the problem is that device and not your router or your modem. Run through troubleshooting steps to see if it's a hardware problem. A poorly performing connection can be caused by broadband router configuration errors, wireless interference, or any of several other technical issues with your home network. Run available diagnostics to fix the causes of slow internet connections. Wi-Fi and other types of wireless connections may perform poorly due to signal interference, which requires computers to continually resend messages to overcome signal issues. Household appliances and even your neighbor's wireless networks can interfere with your computers. To avoid slow internet connections due to signal interference, reposition your router for better performance and change your Wi-Fi channel. Some software applications you install on a computer run as so-called background processes, hidden behind other apps or minimized to the system tray, quietly consuming network resources. Unlike worms, these applications are designed to do useful work and not the kind that you would want to remove from your device. Games and programs that work with videos in particular can heavily utilize your network and cause connections to appear slow. It's easy to forget these applications are running. Always check computers for any programs running in the background when troubleshooting a slow network. Before you start cursing out your internet service provider, or what we call ISP, give your modem and router a quick reset, that is, turn them off, wait a few seconds, and turn them back on to see if that helped at all. Find out what's running slow over your network. Monitor your network to find out what is running over it. There are also various types of applications and network protocols. See who's connected to your Wi-Fi network from your router or computer. Check this periodically to make sure your network has not been compromised. What tools are available? There is NetSpot to identify sense SSIDs in your neighborhood. Survey overall internet access and usage in your neighborhood. Review the signal strength of signals received by your device. There's also GlassWire to identify all active devices on your network. Identify all active devices on your local area network and optimize internet channel utilization. You've gone through all these steps and there's little or no improvement. Consider stepping up the internet speed access with your ISP. If that option is not available or there's no improvement, consider switching to another ISP. Okay, you've been waiting for files to be available, and the wait started in a previous lifetime. If there are no other options, I guess you just have to make do with what you have available. Wait until there's another option. Or... There's home automation and there's home automation. To many, home automation is having a smartphone turn things on and off. That's no different than a remote turning a TV on and off. I asked Marty Winston to give me his thoughts on this.
I've spent the last month facing a predicament involving my 40-year house project, which I believe you know is intended to be ultra-automated. We're talking about networking together, connecting together thousands of sensors, about 100 actuators, about 100 controllers, a lot of them Raspberry Pi. And I, in trying to tell people about this, the best phrase I could come up with was ultra-automated house. It's cool enough. But then I was renting a house near our build site that had too small a place for me. The combination office, workspace, drafting board, prototyping area, everywhere I had to work in was a total of an 11 by 11 bedroom with a closet. Well, we found another place to rent while we're in the design and build phase. And the other place gives me a bonus room over a garage. It's close to 20 by 20. And finally, it lets me get my racks built and do some other stuff. But the place is so badly put together, I have to tell you. And this is really at the root of my conundrum. The guy who, and we're probably talking 15 or 20 years ago, got his idea of automation installed in weird places around here that caused me a lot of frustration. For example, he decided photoelectric controls on the coach lights outside the garage would be smart. So he got the kind that adapts right in the bulb socket. You plug the little photoelectric control in the bulb socket. You screw the bulb into the top of it. You put it back in the coach light. And at night, when it gets dark enough, the photoelectric control trips, turns on the light bulb, which illuminates the photoelectric control, which turns off the light bulb, which, you know, it goes all night, just stuttering through light and dark. Took that control out. There are dimmers on everything. There are dimmers that make no sense. There are little chandelier-style bulbs where normal A19 60-watt bulbs or their LED equivalent should go. This house had so many incandescent bulbs in it when we moved in that if we were ever able to or wanted to burn them all at once, we'd be talking about 10,000 watts, 10 kilowatts in light bulbs. That's just short of 200 bulbs that I'm slowly replacing with LEDs and otherwise keeping them turned off. There were timers on everything. Timers he thought were internal because they had internal rechargeable batteries that the AC power would trickle in and recharge, except batteries don't last forever and there was no backup. If the batteries are removable, we didn't find a way to do that. I just had the electrician pull those dimmers out and put a normal switch in. Most of the places in here with dimmers should be normal switches anyway. Really, do you need a dimmer for the 5 bulbs over your breakfast cereal? That's just not smart in my book. And ceiling floodlights in the wrong places, spotlights in the wrong places. There's one light on the way between our master bathroom and the walk-in closet where there's a floodlight in the ceiling, or it must be a floodlight, but it acts more like a spotlight, probably the can that's in. It doesn't actually illuminate anything useful. It is pretty useless. There are corners of the master bedroom, especially the corner where my dresser is, that don't have light bulbs there at all. I'm going to try to find a table lamp put up there. There's no sense to where lights are, how they're controlled, or anything else. But it was automation. When he did this, this is what home automation meant. There are floodlights in the corners of the house that are supposed to be motion triggered. Some of them are, 2-3 of them are. The rest of them, we can't find a way to turn on or off. There's a light out on the walk and entryway, you know, the kind of pole lamp that we often have coming into a house. Cannot find a switch that can control it. Cannot find a live wire to it. We have switches with wires that don't belong there. Most of the switches and outlets are upside down, as if the electrical code was a secret code that you had to be a member to understand how to deal with. The house is just bizarre. And in this house, I learned a valuable lesson. And the valuable lesson is that was home automation. It is not what I'm doing. What I'm doing doesn't touch what this is doing. So what do I call what I'm doing? I'm making a house, arguably, if you take a look at the definitions from philosophers and so on, arguably, I'm making a house that is sentient, a house that has awareness of its environment, a house that controls itself, doesn't wait for a remote control from a human, a house that responds to its own needs. That meets some of the requirements. I'm not calling it consciousness, but it is sentience. And if I use that word, nobody will know what the heck I mean. So I believe I found a way to describe, and it took me months to come up with this, a simple way to describe what I'm doing that I'm still going to have to explain, but comes much closer than home automation or ultra automation or any of the junk that just means you're remote controlling it with a smartphone. I think this is a cybernetic house, a cyber house. So as you hear me talking about it in the future, cyber house is the term I'm going to use. Now, you're listening to this. I still owe myself an update on writing and wording the entire 40yearhouse.com site. I have not updated it yet. That needs to happen. Keep an eye on it. You might check back in a couple of weeks or a month, depending on how backlogged I get. Here's some of what I'm working on. I'm taking a look at radar as a way to do non-contact measurement of heartbeat to see if we can't determine whether somebody in bed is awake or asleep. Because if they're awake, we don't want to turn the lights off. And if they're asleep, we don't want to leave the lights on. And if the other bed position is empty, that's going to change how we deal with how bright, how dim we leave the lights, because that person might be coming to bed later and prefer not bumping into furniture or the wall. You know what that's like. We're looking at LIDAR. I have been looking at LIDAR a long time for positioning things, especially cars and driveways and that kind of thing. We're certainly looking at beam break, which is an old technology that we have a good use for. We're looking at ways to determine pixel movement in fixed location, not pan, tilt, zoom, fixed point of view cameras, each with a field of view that's a little over 90 degrees, so we can control the view of one next to another and have no gaps, which is important if you're trying to have surveillance that's meaningful to you. We're taking a look at measuring soil moisture by using, this is from a friend at IEEE, by using a technique the satellites use, reflecting radar beams off the ground, not from satellite heights. We'll see what we can get away with the cheap little $7 to $10 modules that are available in places like Amazon and eBay and so on. We're taking a look at capacitive, but probably won't use it. We have some reliability issues there. Passive infrared, in conjunction with other technologies, has a lot of interesting things about it. So radar, LIDAR, ultrasonics, of course, for ranging, pinging, and that kind of thing. It's a lot of technologies. But now that we're in our bigger space, now that we have not only a junk workbench downstairs for working on things like wood and metal, but a really, really nice, talk about it in another segment, a really nice furniture-grade electronics bench set up, we are actively rolled up our sleeves, engaged in prototyping, building the actual elements that will be part of the electronics of the house. And we came to realize, until we get those built, it is almost foolish to start breaking ground and doing other things. Now, we are expecting good news shortly on getting some backing and help from companies that want to take our innovations and incorporate them in commercial buildings. Hey, that's wonderful. That's cool stuff. Meanwhile, the issue is trying to understand what a house needs to take care of itself, trying to understand what people in the house need if the house is going to do some caretaking of them. And that takes a lot of sensors, a lot of planning, a lot of integration. Really takes something I haven't mentioned, a central database, because there is no easier, faster, more sure-footed way of sharing information among 100 different controllers and computers. And actuators, so that it can have an effect on the environment that it is there to smooth out for everybody. It's a cyber house. Now, if you've got a better way to say it, I'm all ears. Drop a note here or go to 40yearhouse.com and drop a note there. But I want to be able to explain this thing in a way where it isn't confused for me saying to a speaker cone somewhere on a table, draw me a picture, pour me a drink, turn off the light that is right here on the desk next to me. No, that's not what home automation is. Home automation is an automated house, not a house that you have to control. You're not the servant of the house through your smartphone. The house is self-controlling. It takes care of itself, and because of assuming those chores, helps take care of you. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Marty. Just to remind everyone, on Wednesday, July 12th, we will have a special broadcast on the convergence of technology with health issues. Public service announcements. The Westchester PC Users Group will be having a presentation on creating stunning photos like a pro using your mobile device with free apps. Meeting time is Thursday, July 6th. That's tomorrow, 7 p.m. They will meet at the Keller Williams Realty, 120 Bloomingdale Road, room 101 in White Plains, New York. The Danbury Area Computer Society will have a presentation on using the iPad with a person living with dementia, Tuesday, July 11th, 7:30 p.m. at the Danbury Hospital Auditorium in Danbury, Connecticut. Rockland PC Users Group will be meeting Tuesday, July 11th, 7:15 p.m. in the Rasa Room on the fourth floor of the Palisades Moor in West Nyack. New York Amateur Computer Club will be meeting on Thursday, July 13th, How I Learned to Live in a House Without Windows. They'll be meeting at NYU Silver Building, Room 411, 31 Washington Place, that's located in Manhattan, New York. Princeton PC Users Group will be meeting July 25th, 7 p.m., in the community room of the Princeton Public Library in Princeton, New Jersey. Brookdale Computer Users Group will be meeting on Thursday, July 27th at 7 p.m. Topic of presentation is Troubleshooting Your Computer 101. They will be meeting at the Middletown Library Large Community Room in Middletown, New Jersey. These meetings are all open to the public, and there's no charge to attend the meetings at all. And you're all welcome at these meetings. The website for the Personal Computer Show is pcradioshow.org, and we communicate via Twitter at pcradio212. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, on the Internet, and 9 p.m. Eastern Time on WBAI-FM 99.5 New York, on the radio, or wbai.org, streaming on the Internet. In the meantime, stay in touch. And keep on computing, and always back up, and back up. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and stay cool until we meet again. Same time, same station next week.